Join longtime local and social butterfly Michelle Dragony as she flits up and down the coastside on her intrepid cruiser Flame, chatting with coastal characters at every turn.
So here we are this morning with the coastal butterfly and Chris Loswick, a local surfer and a homegrown boy. So Chris, how did you get here, right here today, from being homegrown here on the coastside?
Homegrown, I guess, yeah. Born and raised in Half Moon Bay, it's a great place to grow up, especially if you're a surfer. It's the reason I've stuck around for as long as I have.
What elementary school did you go to?
I think I went to Wilkinson, and then I went to Farallon, and then I went to Cunha. It was a good transition.
That's cool, nice. And up to the high school. Nice.
And then up to the high school.
And were you surfing at the high school?
I was, yeah. I think I was on the first high school surf team ever to be kind of formulated with Kurt Myers as our coach. I always give it up to Kurt for coaching on the first high school surf team because he really went out of his way to drive us down there, didn't get reimbursed for gas, didn't get reimbursed for his time. He just took it out of the goodness of his heart to, like, give back to a surfing community, a younger generation. So that's why I've always been a coach on the high school surf team, if I can, if I have the time. Kurt was always a huge mentor of mine, and I just thought, man, I got to be more Kurt-like. That was so huge in my life as a Grom. It was like him and Scott Crump and Ron Cusera, and even Mark Marshall chipped in a bunch to my earlier career in surfing. So I try to emulate that and give back to the youth as much as I can, try to be a good influence on them.
Oh, I think my son started surfing about 7 years ago with Hunter and Malcolm and Thomas, and now Thomas and Hunter are surfing Mavericks, you know? And I know Eric and Kurt have done a couple of shots of them while they're surfing at Mavericks.
And backside, too.
And I know, backside. I saw this one drop that Hunter took, and I was like, whoa, man, that was crazy.
What's cool about those kids, too, is they do a lot of other activities. They're into water polo, they're into swimming, and it's not just primarily surfing. And I think that's good in life, especially early on, not to have just one hobby that you do all the time, because heaven forbid if you can't surf anymore, what are you going to do? Are you going to go out and just party your ass off? Are you going to get in trouble? Or do you have, like, other hobbies that will facilitate, like, a healthy lifestyle when you're not just surfing? And that was a huge wake-up call for me when I was a kid, because that's all I did was surf. And when I wasn't surfing, I didn't know what to do. So now I incorporate yoga, working out, running, cycling, the whole gambit, just to keep myself busy. You know, the arts, drawing, writing, reading a bunch, listening to podcasts. Like, if you're not busy, you're going to get in trouble. A boring lifestyle is not a life worth living. And you're only as bored as you let yourself get.
I remember one of the first conversations I had with you years ago, you may not remember this, but I spent a lot of time at Kelly watching the boys surf, driving them around. And often I would sit down and somebody would sit down and we'd have long conversations. And I was reading East of Eden, and we had this conversation about Steinbeck, because I'd grown up in England, and I didn't know that much about American authors, and I was floored at how much you knew about Steinbeck. And it's like, you know, you're right. You feed yourself. I mean, that's what you're doing, and I think that's a great example for the boys.
Yeah, actually, I really like that book, East of Eden, the battle between good and evil.
Absolutely.
It's such a powerful metaphor. That was one of the first books I read when I got back to Half Moon Bay at the ripe age of 28. And it was just such a fabulous novel. You just eat up the pages.
And the setting as well. I mean, it's so familiar. In fact, I was just at the Half Moon Bay History Association speaking engagement last night. And they had this lady from the San Mateo History Association, and she did a talk on Prohibition. You know, you go back to that East of Eden period of time. And I'm trying to get the video of that lecture because it was a hoot. This was the most radical county in California.
Salinas Valley?
Yes, this whole area up and down the coast with all the bootleggers and stuff like that, you know, with feeding, you know, San Francisco. That, I mean, it was de rigueur for everybody to drink during Prohibition on the coastside. And even the sheriffs, you know, had pictures, you know, being at different bars and stuff like that and speakeasies.
Well, you make it illegal, it's all the more temptation, right?
Right. Exactly.
I like what they did in Portugal, and they just legalized all drugs, and the crime rate went significantly down. And what they did is, instead of incarcerating people and putting money towards that, drug offenders, they actually put money towards rehabilitation centers and
smart.
And putting money into, like, rehabilitating addicts and pushing recovery on them and putting them in rehab, and it just made all the difference. And once you minus that criminal activity from drugs and alcohol in a prohibition, it becomes much less an offense.
And
look at places like Colorado, where they legalized marijuana, and it's bringing in more taxes than alcohol did this year, and the housing has went up 19% in Colorado. That's even more than the Bay Area. The Bay Area has only risen 14%. This is one of the highest housing surges we've ever had. So I think it's really good that they're slowly but surely legalizing everything. Not that I even engage in narcotics anymore. I just think from a standpoint of for the greater good.
Oh, no, I agree, too. I'm sort of surprised that California's been so slow, you know, to see the light and treat drugs not as a legal issue but as a health issue. I mean, and I know drugs on the coast are, you know, there's a lot of partying that goes on in high school. And I think...
I took part in it when I was a kid.
It's actually a partying culture. Even, you know, I could think of my playgroup. We had barbecues every weekend, you know, where there's beer and wine and you know, the kids are running around and... And so I think, you know, the kids are raised certainly and partially in a culture. And the surfing culture, you know, tends to be sort of a partying culture as
well. Completely.
And I think, you know, amongst my mom friends, you know, we tried to treat it not as something that you can't stop. You can't stop it. But we tried to treat it, if you're going to party, how are you going to party responsibly? You know? And the whole drinking and driving thing, you know, we made sure that the kids really understood, you know, here is Dennis, Half Moon Bay taxi driver's, you know, phone number, put it in your phone.
That's awesome.
And make sure that, you know, and it's great. It's just such a small town. I can see Dennis on Sunday morning and he'll say, oh yeah, I got Xander and, you know, whoever home, you know, and everything was good. And it's as a mom, I just was at my teen cert class up at the high school yesterday and we had this CHP guy do a speaking engagement up there, and it was an hour and a half of, I don't know if you remember, Red Asphalt, the movie where they show
No way, they're still showing that?
They're Red Asphalt 5 now.
I can only imagine.
Honestly, I was exhausted by the point.
I want to check one of those out just for
I'm trying to get, I mean, it was nasty phenomenal. And it was gory, and I remember at Red Asphalt 1.
Oh,
you know, that's how old I am.
And, that'll give you nightmares.
He had to tell the kids, you know, it's a bit graphic. And then you could see some of the people had to look away. I mean, you know, you were really looking at dead bodies and parts of bodies and stuff like that. And
not pretty.
But the message to the kids was, number one that kills teenagers is reckless driving.
Yeah, I went to Hawaii for 3 years. I went to school out there. Well, the first time I went to Hawaii, I went for 5 months with a girlfriend of mine. And I just wanted to go out there and surf the North Shore and live with my girl out there. And it was one of those things where I was on the fence because I was borderline, still going to college, still getting my associate's degree, not knowing where I want to go. And should I just jump and just go live on my own in Hawaii? And honestly, it was one of the best things I ever did. Because for 5 months, I lived... two houses from the beach on Rocky Point on Oahu, and I surfed every morning, and I worked three different jobs, and it really gave me, like, respect for earning to pay rent and then taking care of everything in between. I worked at Cholo's, busing tables, and then I worked at Celestial's, a health food restaurant, washing dishes, and I worked at a surf shop called Surf and Sea, really popular. And from each one of those, I learned different things. It was amazing. From the surf shop, I learned sales. I remember the sales manager came up to me and said, Chris, we got to talk about your numbers. You're not pulling your weight. Your sales are way down low. You got to step it up. And after that, I just turned it up. And I was so competitive that by the end of the month, me and this girl were neck and neck for top sales of the month. And then she beat me on the last day because she sold a ton of clothes and I only sold a few surfboards and stuff. And I just shook her hand and said, you did a great job. And I got second place that month. And it was amazing what you can apply yourself and do.
That is cool.
And then from Celestials, the health food, I would watch people cook all day long. And I remember the first time the guy told me to scoop an avocado and just cut it. So I was taking a knife and trying to carve it out. And he's like, what the hell are you doing? Grab a spoon, bro. And after that, man, I know how to cut avocados and spoon them out. And it helped my cooking, like, evolve. When I came back from Hawaii, my dad goes, how'd you learn to cook so good?
Yeah.
In the kitchen.
Yeah.
And Cholo's, that was just spoke for itself. The Mexican restaurant on the North Shore. I remember my first day bussing tables. I worked so freaking hard that everyone was blown away and they tipped me $100. And they're like, a busser's never made this much in one night. And I literally never made that much again. Because they all just knew I was going to work that hard. And
you were on fire.
I loved it out there. So then I came back and I started getting my college education online. And finally,
tell me about that. What do you mean, college education online? What did you do?
So I took, I got expelled out of college from San Diego State. So then I had to get back online, go to community college. Gotcha. And I went there for around 100 units. Okay. And finally, a counselor took me in his office and said, you can't take any more classes here at community college. You literally have to take one more semester and then transfer. And we got to make sure these are all transferable units. Right. Where do you want to go?
Right.
And so my brother was already in Hawaii going to UH, so I got all the prerequisites to transfer, and I transferred to UH with a communications major. And then I spent 2 years there living with my brother and his girlfriend and living on the South Shore, which is a whole different experience in Oahu than living on the North Shore.
Right.
And I got a job at a great Italian restaurant that would pull in like $200 cash a night, and it was just great money. I used to bike to work in Waikiki and then work all night and then go to school all day. And then I had tons of time to surf, and it was just this like incredible experience.
Sounds awesome.
And my mom paid for all my education because my grandma had passed away. So they sold grandma's house, and then my mom got a chunk of the money. And she's like, well, you kids can go to school now.
Aww.
So she paid my $5,000 a semester for 4 semesters in a row.
Aww.
And then I was out, debt-free. It was like
such a gift.
I know.
Such a gift. In fact, I was listening to something on NPR about college debt.
When I hear that, I feel guilty all the time. I'm like, I don't have any debt, man.
Yeah, no, but I think, you know, there was a guy, what was the title of the book? There is life after college, something like that. There really is life after college. But one of the things, he was talking about how there were sprinters, and there were wanderers, and there were stragglers. And it's kind of a third of the people, they get out of college, they don't have too much debt. That's one of the biggest things, because if you have too much debt, then you're constrained as to where you can work.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, two-thirds of college people don't actually finish their degrees. The wanderers and the stragglers. So when you're back in the day, I'm 54, born in 61. And so for me, I was just on the cusp of the idea that if you went to college, you would get a job, period.
Yeah.
But really, I was probably the last of those types of people because, pretty soon, you start hearing people, who are in their 30s, not even being, having college degrees, but not getting jobs, and stuff
Completely.
Like that. And even now, I have 12 years of college. I have 4 college degrees, 2 2-years, 1 master's and a BA, and a couple of teaching credentials. But after being a mom for 17 years, you can't get a job. College doesn't have that same meaning anymore.
Yeah, completely.
What it has to do with is more like what you're doing. You are just sucking down all these skills,
And I'm loving it.
And sort of, CoastsideBuzz.com or CoastsideRadio.com, we're in the middle of rebranding right now. I really didn't know how to do any of this stuff. I'd never done.
You're doing
any,
pretty good
never,
at it now.
Never done any recording or anything. But if you don't know something, you just Google that.
YouTube it.
And so I was curious when you said online. I know my son's done a lot of online courses. I homeschooled for a while, and I see online college as being something that's much less expensive. For people.
I took a lot of online classes, actually.
Right.
It's much more manipulable to your schedule.
Exactly.
Because I'd get off work at like 11 at night, and then I'd go take my online classes from 11 to 2 in the morning, and then I'm done.
It was
the weirdest hours ever, and I'm trying to switch that now and wake up early and be a normal person and not so much of a vampire. Awake at night, sleep during the day.
Well, it's funny, you can get away with it when you're younger.
Exactly.
I mean, one of the things they talk about, I just couldn't believe it when I saw it happening as the kids would get older, how these kids would be up early at 6 o'clock in the morning, when they're below 10, And then after 10, they're, you know, rarely up before 10 o'clock in the, or 12 o'clock at noon. And, you know, they stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, at first you think, oh, it's just a lack of discipline, you know, or they're just YouTubing. But it's really, you can see that their circadian rhythms, whatever it is, when they're teenagers. And now all the research is showing they're actually starting high school an hour later now.
Yeah.
And starting next year.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's good for the sleep cycles. Yeah. I've worked in a restaurant 15 years and it was really throwing off my circadian rhythm. Because I'm like, sometimes, you know, you get that schedule, you get to work at 5 p.m., 3:30 p.m., you start work at 5, and you just start slamming coffee, and then you get off around 12, 1, and you sometimes go to bed at 4 in the morning.
Right.
It's like a bartender's lifestyle. It's crazy. And then you wake up at 12, and then you go duddle around the house for a little while, maybe get some exercise if you're lucky. And one of my friends who was 62 in the restaurant business, he couldn't do it anymore. He says, that's young man's work. I can't just live to be at work.
Right.
It's crazy. And then he just stopped working there, and now he's like, I'm getting exercise. He's retired. He's doing things for himself. He's hanging out with friends, family. He's going to games. Couldn't be happier.
That's cool.
And then he comes back and he drives the shuttle, you know, 2 times a week during the day. Great for him.
Yeah.
He has a big smile. He's cracking jokes again. So it makes a big difference.
Well, I know when growing up, my dad retired when I was 18 or 19. So I saw this guy, you know, he'd been a corporate guy. You know, he was never home. And all of a sudden, he was home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have the opportunity to sit and read the paper, talk to me before I would go to college, and garden, and he'd cook, and he started volunteering. And I'd been sort of wondering what I wanted to do when I grew up. And I realized that I wanted to be retired. That's what I wanted to do. But not be bored and retired.
That's how I always tell people to retire. You're my hero. I'm going to live through you.
Well, exactly. And I sort of tried to set a goal that by 50, you know, I wanted to be retired. But, you know, it doesn't really work that way these days. Nobody really retires anymore.
Exactly.
But you
keep working to stay young.
But like your shuttle driving friend, your 62-year-old, I mean, you have to pedal back as you get older a little bit. There's a lot of work that you used to do that doesn't really suit you as you get older. And I sort of, you know, this is sort of what Coastsider Radio is a little bit about, reinventing myself as well and just doing little bits and pieces of things that I enjoy doing. And I like to work with people. And I know one of the things that, you know, we were talking about before we started the show was, you, I didn't know you had a communications degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that you wanted to do podcasts, as in you do podcasts.
Very much so. That's all I do, is listen to podcasts.
and I'm finding, as I interview people, I'm finding all these kinds of synergistic ways that we can work together to, you know, get people's messages out and to have fun, too. I mean, plain have fun. And so I know after you came back here, you got into real estate. Is that right?
That's correct. I actually want to tell a story about graduating college. I went and traveled the world after. And I had like 25 grand, and I was like, you know what? I have the rest of my life to work. I'm just going to go travel. So I picked up with a girlfriend, and we went to Mexico for 5 weeks, and then we went to Australia for 5 weeks, and then we went to Indonesia for 2 months. And by the end, in Indonesia, we finally broke up. It was too much of a trip together. But Mexico is really cool because I love Spanish. I love learning the language. And staying at Puerto Escondido is like other families to me there. Mm-hmm. Like, I know a lot of old gentlemen there that are like dads to me. And the locals are pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely a cool little area to spend time in. And I studied Spanish every day, and I just loved it.
Nice.
I got to use it, and I went to the gym, and it was just great.
The perfect 20-year-old decade. I mean, really. I mean, rocking it out of the park. Time in Hawaii, traveling the world, you know, and sucking down all of these skills so that you know you can figure out what you want to do. I think I didn't do that. I regret that actually. I should have taken a little bit more time and sort of thought about what I wanted to do. And but I think that's just fantastic. And Indo for how long?
2 months.
Oh my!
So I really loved Indonesia. I've always wanted to go there. It was the second time I went there, and this time I met a lot of cool friends. And by meeting friends, you just develop these cool relationships, and they already have ties in the community. Like, I met this one guy, Bali Jim, and he's from Florida originally, but he spent like the last 20, 30 years in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
He looks total white, gringo guy, but speaks fluent Balinese and Indonesian, and he just blows people away because he's a trader there. So he buys in masses and then sells them to the traders who sell little trinkets and stuff in Florida.
Uh-huh.
So he actually owned a boat, and he was like, I got in really good with him,
mm-hmm.
him and his family. He's like, I'm going to take you on my boat. We're going to go surfing. So I hooked up with all three of his friends, and we went out to this, this small little island chain that no one even surfs, and we just scored, like, perfect waves by ourselves.
Oh,
and I was the only young buck on the boat, so they were just like, you're awesome. I was like, everyone's surfing hero. I was like, this is a great surf trip. We gave the camera to the Balinese boat guy. He never even shot photos in his life. He got the most memorable, amazing photos I've ever got in my surf career. It was like amazing. And then I was so fired up when I got back. I just hopped on my scooter the next morning. And I went and checked Padang Padang, and it was flat. So I rode on my scooter an hour and a half, and I went surfed this other wave that I've always wanted to surf, this right on the north side. And I surfed all morning, and I just went and I powered up with a power bar on the beach, and I went right back out. And I was going so hard, I blew out my knee.
Oh, no.
So I hurt my knee that day.
Oh, no. Was that the end of Indonesia then?
That was the end, yeah. That was like 8 more days before I left, so it was a good time to leave. And there's a funny story on the way back from that surfing expedition. I had a hurt knee. I was on my moped, and the police are infamous over there. So I was passing a cop, and then he pulls me over. And I thought I could beat him on my moped, so I just ran the red light. But he just sped past me, and he was on, like, a Ducati, like, and I was on a moped, so he's just laughing at me. He's like, you got to pull over, kid. And I tried to give him money quick, and he wouldn't take it, but I knew he was going to take it. And I tried to give him money again, he wouldn't take it. And then he's like, I'm going to take you to jail. And I'm like, no, you're not. And I finally gave him all my money, and then he just let me go.
Wow.
But I tried to get away from him, because that's what you do in Indo.
Is that right?
Yeah, you see the cop and they tell you to pull over, you just speed past them through traffic because they're always just trying to get money out of you. They really don't want to take you to jail. Everything in Indonesia is crazy because they don't have like a set government system. They don't have a trash facility system, so they just burn their trash. Huh. They just dump it in their neighbor's yard.
Wow.
It's so dirty in Indonesia. Huh. All the beaches when it's onshore winds are just covered in plastic bottles like you wouldn't believe.
Really?
The trash and pollution in Indonesia was the worst kind I've ever seen.
Huh. I'm surprised nuts. That, you know, being that so many surfers go there, that there isn't a movement to make it better.
So my buddy, Bali Jim, is trying to make that movement where he's trying to do a packageless grocery store. So I was helping shoot video and make a documentary on it. It's a really good idea, but they just need some kind of trash organization because it's disgusting over there.
Right.
And then it's all based on bribery. So if you open a business, you have to, instead of paying taxes, you pay bribery to everyone, like the police, the government. So when I came back to California finally, I realized all these paved roads, all these trash is all due to the taxes we pay. And I just had this new appreciation for it. But when I came back to California, I graduated college. You know, I traveled the world. I was broke. My knee was broken. I was brokenhearted because my girlfriend was terrible. But I just started searching for that job you pine after college. Like, oh, I should get a perfect job. Now I graduated college. For 3 months, I struggled. Just job interviews, 5 a week. Boom, boom,
really?
Boom. I wanted to go to, like, I don't know, the Navy, the Coast Guard. I wanted to go to the Ritz-Carlton. I wanted to do the tech world. I wanted to do this.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that. Finally, I just said, you know what, God? The next job that comes into my life, I'm just going to do. And Rocky Corson called me. Remember Rocky?
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, hey, Chris, I got this job. I don't want to do it, but I thought maybe you'd want to do it. It's putting up insulation under someone's house. I said, you know what? Sure. So I did that job, and it was a crawl space you could barely get under, and it was so small I couldn't even rotate my shoulders underneath it, and it was the scariest, the worst job I've ever had to do. Itchy, black widow,
no, I've done
dirty,
it. Horrible.
In your eye. The first time I crawled in 10, 15 feet in the blackness.
Yeah.
I crawled right back out, called Rocky, I don't want to do this,
yeah.
I don't want to do this. And then finally, I just got bold, and I just started hustling through that. And then I called Rock, and I'm like, I need help doing this. And he was 61 at the time. He just crawled under that house. He was totally comfortable. He flipped on his back. He was taking naps down there. He was cracking jokes. He's like, pass me more of that cotton candy, Chris. What the hell, Rock?
Oh.
by the end, we wear gloves under there. Right. I was crawling in the back of the house just squashing black widows with my fingers.
Really? Oh, yuck.
Oh, it was disgusting. So that was the worst job I've ever had, practically. So when I got a job at the Ritz-Carlton, I was like, man, this is so much easier than crawling under the house and doing insulation. This is a dream. So sometimes you got to do the worst job before you have appreciation for the next job.
This is true.
Yeah, at the Ritz-Carlton, it's been a beautiful blessing in my life because I've always been in the hospitality. I started bussing tables there, and I worked my way up to the lead server, and then I was making $120,000 a year as a server.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? So I bought a house, I bought a condo on the beach in Pacifica, right across from the pier, with that money, because they give you like a 401k, they have proof of income. Like, it's been awesome. And then I graduated into real estate because it's always something I've been wanting to do. And with real estate, there's no glass ceiling, so you can work as much as you want, and you can work as hard as you want, and make as much as you want. But it's kind of a double-edged sword because you can make zero, or you can make a million.
Right.
And it's a very grown-up profession. Like, the people I roll with in this profession are 50, 60 years old,
right,
and they're killing it. And that's who I want to emulate in my life. And I like the flexibility that real estate provides, because when I have a family, a wife, kids, I'd like to show up for their soccer games and just be available to make my own schedule. The tough part about real estate is you make your own schedule.
Right, exactly. It sounds like you've got that discipline down.
I do.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Right. It's funny. My son is going to SBCC, Santa Barbara Community College, with his friend Thomas, and their dream is to be hedge fund managers. That's their dream.
Tight.
And they're going to major in finance and stuff like that. I think it's just really exciting that they're willing to do that. And I said, Thomas was asking me a lot of questions about real estate, because I just bought a vacant lot recently. And in the harbor right next to my studio.
No kidding.
And that lot right next to
you purchased that?
Yeah.
I parked right in front of it, so it's good you own it.
and he was asking me all of these questions. They were really good questions. And I said, you know what? You should get your real estate license. Not necessarily to, you know, to be a real estate agent, but if you go, it's like a 2-week course, or, you know, it's a course or
completely,
whatever it is.
Yeah, it's just three classes and you take the test.
Exactly. Boom. But at the end of that, you'll be a much better real estate purchaser. I mean, I had to pay way too much for the vacant lot. But the idea for the vacant lot is I'm going to put a kayak and boat storage and bike storage there.
You rent tents on Airbnb?
No, right now there's no living either in my studio or on the property. It's not zoned for that.
Oh, okay. So you're renting somewhere?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Exactly. I've got a camper at a friend's house.
How's that lifestyle?
Oh, I love it. The back door of my camper opens out onto the vista of it's up on a hill. You see Half Moon Bay and the ocean from my back camper door. So
from 20, you had a mobile home, and now
I'm kind of back to the camper. Exactly.
It's a full circle.
The circle of life. Exactly. But I wanted to buy this property because they're going to be putting an ADA dock system down here. Beautiful, 150-foot with three arms.
I love
arms,
this area too, in the harbor.
And a boathouse with two pavilions with, you know, ramps going down.
I think it's
going
to blow up in the next 10 years.
I think so.
I mean, with the restaurants and
nothing in the inner harbor has really
so
been
beautiful.
Developed.
Yeah.
And you know, the LCP really review is just finishing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know if you know this, but they're rezoning. Mm-hmm. This is going from waterfront to commercial. Caretaking units are all up in a jumble. One of the things that I've been talking to the county about is, you know, parking on the waterfront is not a preference, because you don't want to use the waterfront up for parking.
Mm-hmm.
The county really hasn't addressed the issue, and the idea that I had that I pitched to Summer Burleson just recently, because now I have this property and I'll probably have more people than my parking spaces allow.
Yeah.
But I want to serve the dock. I want to serve, you know, I want to be able to with the yacht club and with Maverick's, you know, paddle shop. There's going to be a lot of people on this road. So how are we going to deal with it? Well, maybe we create a loading zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one idea. And then we create infill parking. I've been working with Chris Nishkin at Bike Works. We have this idea of bike hubs, you know, where people, you know, they have them up in the city where you swipe your card and then you grab a bike. And so somebody
really
could unload
idea.
their boat, they could go park somewhere, grab a bike, you know, and then come back and paddle and then go back and get their car. And we've got to do something, you know. And then people, like, who have too many people, we would buy parking spaces. So if my if I have the storage and becomes more people.
That's how they do it in Hawaii.
Exactly. Yeah, you buy parking somewhere else. So that
very
you,
urban, and there's not a lot of parking. So right.
And so as, parking spaces. As you see, there are people that are doing this type of stuff already.
Yeah.
And I challenge, you know, the county to use our, we're a stone's throw from Silicon Valley. There is not a community anywhere in the world that has more access to technology and smart thinking than the coastside.
Right.
And we're very unique in that, you know, I don't know, I have kind of crazy idea of just shutting down the harbor. You know, just locals can get in and out. And then just create like a Mackinac Island where people are, you know, you get out of your car. You park and you get out of your car. You don't get back in your car until you go home.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, that's a good point about technology, too, because I feel like in the real estate business, there's a lot of older realtors that are very, they just don't want to adopt technology at this point. Like, I got addressed the other day when a younger realtor brought up, hey, we can get all our listings on our phone, so we don't need to print them out each and waste all this paper. And one of the older realtors lady was like, I'm never going to do that. As long as I live, I'm going to be on paper. And we're all like, whoa,
right.
Okay, kill those trees, lady.
Yeah, well, no, one of my teaching credentials is in computing, and I taught adults, you know, computers from back
then.
The resistance is amazing.
I just go, what are you fighting so hard for?
Well, I think part of it is a cognitive issue, both behavioral and cognitive. I mean, it's actually a really deep issue.
It's easier.
it is, but even I call myself a sort of a techno hippie Silicon Valley brat. I mean, my dad was corporate. He worked for Ampex. I was raised with the best technology. I mean, we had the first tape recorder. We had the first TV. You know, all that kind of stuff. And you know, as a you know, computer person, I always have the best Mac. You know, I mean, it wouldn't occur to me to not, you know, I. But even for me, I remember when I started working for was a water engineering company, and we were doing a lot of research. And I was pretty techno savvy, but their printer was down, and the printer was down for 2 months, and we just got used to not printing anything out. I did have to get two screens though, because I just had I needed more environment.
I love two screens.
But I've learned to. I really don't print out anymore. But for 2 months I could feel the resistance. You know, I could just it was hard. You know, I had to sort of push myself, and so that was, you know, I do understand what, you know, older people are feeling in terms of that. And honestly, when you're the manipulation of paper is so significantly different than the screen, there's probably a pretty good reason why she can't, you know, go to the screen. But I think, honestly, if you don't, you know, as somebody who's 54, if you don't do that, by the time I'm 70, I won't be able to function in society.
Completely.
And I certainly wouldn't be able to do this business. This business has really forced me to do everything on the most cutting edge. And in point of fact, you know, I'm working with a TV producer right now on a country western music show, and he's a big time, you know, been in LA in the city, and you know, is doing the commercial for Maruchan ramen noodles. And and you know, I saw his ad and everything, and you know, they're going to, you know, put it on Food Network. They bought Food Network time. This was his big money. And I was saying, but you know, you can promote on Facebook. You can buy Facebook ads, and you can promote on Facebook for X dollars, you know, which is like 30 or 40, depending on how much you want to spend on your Facebook ad. And I said, and then you can redistribute with, you know, Coastside Buzz, CoastsideRadio.com, and I'm just another distribution channel. And I'm a lot less expensive, but it's powerful because we're using the internet. And he's 70, and he took a little while to sort of think about it, but he circled back and he said, I think that we should be doing something with, you know, your Facebook and Coastsider Radio. And so I work with three girls, Mackenzie Garrity and Robin Graham and Carmen Guerrera, and they are Papa Vera Marketing, and they do my SEO, my hard coding, and my Google Analytics. And
I think that's an important topic because you have a whole team behind you.
It is.
Working on your SEO, your hard coding, and your Google Analytics.
All separate skills. And what we were talking, you know, earlier about how we would get a college degree and then that would be your job for the rest of your life. And it's like, you can't do that now. You got to keep building skills and, as I say, sucking it down as much as you can. And I know just enough to keep them all going.
But I think you're doing that the Ford theme where you're hiring people that are smarter than you to do the stuff that you need done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like, ask me any question because I'll make a phone call and get the answer for you from my team.
Exactly. And then that's like exactly how it works. So he wanted to hire me as a media consultant, and I said, well, unfortunately, I'm not really the consultant. It's Mackenzie. I think she's 28, and she's a local grown girl, but she lives in Italy because she married an Italian, and she's a digital nomad girl. I mean, she's so modern. I love this woman.
She's
amazing.
She can work wherever she wants. She's in Italy working now.
She can. And I just had to hire.
As long as she has a strong internet connection.
Yeah, and she has I just hired another web person to help me with the calendar and the directory. And she lives in Norway. She just moved from Turkey. She's actually a refugee, and she's now in Norway.
Wow.
And it's an interesting, the world is getting so small now. And it's an interesting way to go about funding media. You know, I have to compete with TV. I have to compete with radio. And they're very expensive. And honestly, what I record on cost me $200. We're recording right now on a Roland RO5, which is, it's a standalone recording object, and it cost me $200, maybe $250. And then I also record with my phone an AVR Pro with an Apogee mic, which also costs $200, and the app, I think, is $499. Mm-hmm. So in terms of producing content, I can be very inexpensive. And so $2,000. Exactly. And the amount of time it takes me to train people, somebody like you, it takes me 5 minutes. Somebody who doesn't have any experience, maybe it takes me a couple of hours. But, I use Audacity to edit, which is a free, sound software. And, it takes, once you learn how to, upload into WordPress, that's, it takes you 15 minutes to learn how to do that.
Mm.
And the more producers that I work with who want to do podcasts and shows like that, that's how I keep my content costs down. By sort of what I call the Tom Sawyer approach to fence painting, only I'm doing podcasts. Isn't this fun? unlike fence painting, though, this is actually really fun.
I can tell. You have so much enthusiasm for it, and it shows in your work because your content's amazing.
Well, thank
your website comes right up, has great SEO, has great readability. It comes up on the iPhone as good as it comes up on the regular laptop. So,
Ram, did you hear that? Thank you. No, we work really hard. I mean, there are certain codes of honor, I think, that you have with a website. And one of the things is it needs to be fast. The other thing that is really changing is advertising. You don't really do advertising anymore. It's more promoted content. And to sell something today, you actually have to give some sort of intellectual property away. Not too much, just enough to make you sound smart and people want to know more from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like when I'm working with, I just did an interview with The Barn. And so that's a restaurant. And we talked a lot about what their menu was like and what their events were like so that, there's a lot of things that they're doing. And I think it's maybe a 15 or a 20-minute interview. It's like with you. You are a real estate agent for what real estate company?
Avant Real Estate Group.
And I noticed with your card, it's actually up in the city. So are you doing commercial real estate?
I would like to. I haven't done yet. Mostly residential.
But and mostly on the coast side?
No, I go from the city all the way to Redwood City. So from San Francisco, I drive to do the whole Bay Area. Done properties in Oakland, San Leandro, Pacifica, El Granada, Redwood City, as I said, and I'm open to anything. Just because I'm new in the business, take anything that comes,
that's
for sure.
Cool.
And it's all about marketing. So I like to do video content. I'm trying to do more podcasts into my business plan. I do door knocking. I do cold calling, warm calling. I do it all. I get a lot of clients off Facebook and then off Zillow.
Do you?
I do, yeah. A lot of people are like, people I went to high school with, stuff like that. And they're like, man, I love what you're doing, man. You're working so hard. Because when I graduated with a bachelor's degree, I knew that was going to be the last degree I get for a long time. And I was just going to continue to increase my knowledge by reading and taking classes and stuff like that. Yeah. But I wasn't going to go for a master's. Because a lot of people are, I think, under the false pretense that if you get one more degree, maybe that job will be at the end of that degree.
Right.
So they're like, oh, the bachelor's, the job's not waiting yet. I should get a master's. Oh, the job's not waiting yet. For me, it was just like, I got to get my bachelor's and start earning. because I never had that chance before in life, because I was always like, oh yeah, I'm just going to keep going to college until I get a degree, and then I'll start working, making money. So
it's funny that you came to the same conclusion that I did, even though we're, you know, about 25 years apart. I remember I was going for my PhD, and the guy that I was working for at the time, his name was D. Hawk. He actually invented the credit card. He invented Bank America card and Visa.
My God.
Fantastic. It was 2 years of research, and it was just amazing. But I wanted to get my PhD because I, too, wanted to have some more letters. I always wanted to be the mad, my initials are M-A-D. I always wanted to be, have mad PhD on my license plate. Isn't that a funny
reason?
Crazy
things PhD. That keep us going. That's amazing.
and it was going to be a PhD in education, and I wanted, and it was actually, I was writing a book called Evolutionary Education, which was really sort of a just-in-time delivery system for education that is really modeled after the homeschool movement. It's very much like that. I was trying to take that kind of thing and apply it to public schools, because public schools need a lot of change, really. They need to be using more online stuff. The teachers shouldn't be developing curriculum anymore. There's so many curriculum developers out online. What they should be doing is understanding what curriculum is out there and delivering it to their students as facilitators. So I see a lot of change that could happen.
That's the one complaint teachers give me frequently, is we have to plan the whole lesson plan.
It's ridiculous.
It's so time consuming. Right. Well, if it wasn't time-consuming, what would you be doing? Oh, giving better service to your
That's
students.
That's exactly right.
Making sure they learn and attending to their needs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it was funny. I actually I applied to UCSC, Santa Cruz, to the History of Consciousness program. And Dee Hawk, you know, he would say, they're not going to teach you anything, Michelle. You know, you already know more than what they know. And I go, no, there's no way. There's no way. And I had, like, you know, 4.0. And I had all these, you know, famous people, basically, you know, had written me recommendations and stuff like that. And my little beginning dissertation thing, you know, for the application was really good. And I didn't get in. And I was like, what? I mean,
Shocker.
At that time, I'd never not gotten into anything. I think I've gotten every interview, every job I've ever interviewed for, I got. So to not get in, I was like, what? And I called the professor up and I said, what do you mean I didn't get in? And she said, well, we don't have anybody here to direct your dissertation. And I go, well, okay, well, the cart before the horse. So at what point do you have unique thought then? I mean, you have to have somebody who's already thought what I've thought to, you know, guide me in my dissertation. Can't I have a completely unique thought? I mean, if you're the history of consciousness and your focus is human organization, and I am talking about, you know, the fundamental organization of education in America, who else am I going to go to? And in fact, I'd already gone to USF, and they have a great doctoral program. It costs a lot of money, but it's more for people who are just kind of getting the letters. It's not really a research. It's more of a mill. I mean, I don't mean to be derogatory, but it's just you're already got a job, and you just need to get the PhD so that you can get the next job, you know, kind of thing.
Interesting.
It's an upgrade thing. It's very common in education because that's how admin, you know,
principals. Education is the only thing that's recession-proof.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Kind of a business.
Right. And so anyway, I didn't get in, and I ended up, it was funny, when I had my son, I met homeschoolers, and homeschooling was everything that I was describing with evolutionary education, only these were parents, mostly college-educated parents, but and even the internet was not as strong as it was when we first started. You know, my son's 17, so this is, you know, 2 and 3, I mean, it was still not very Googleable. But the flexibility that we had with our kids. I mean, I remember the most flexible example would be a girl that was 10, and her mother wasn't teaching her to read, and I was freaking out on her behalf as an English teacher. How can you not do that? She says, well, she's just not ready. And I go, what do you mean she's not ready? Well, her mother was right, and this is part of the cognitive research that we've come to understand by, you know, watching homeschoolers do their thing.
What normal age are kids supposed to read at?
So, Xander started reading, was reading Harry Potter at five and a half.
Makes sense, and, yeah. So at 10, you were freaking out.
But, you know, he was my kid, and so
what
I was teaching.
What are you doing?
I was teaching him
you
how to
idiot.
Read.
Idiot!
Right. But he didn't have any issues, and I can't speak to whatever, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, there's ADD, there's, you
so
know,
this 10-year-old
and so
pulled it together.
By the age of 11 and a half. She learned how to read in about 6 weeks.
Just,
and what her mother had done up until that time, though, is that she'd auditorily taught her all about art. She herself was an artist. And she'd taught her, you know, about history, but
I bet she has a much higher retention auditorily.
Exactly. And so everybody's brain is different. And, you know, when you really give yourself to the absolute unique flexibility of each individual human being from an educational perspective, mm-hmm. you start to see this huge difference in how you would approach teaching. You know, I had one friend who had four kids, four different math programs, because one was a boy, three were girls. And the two girls learned differently. The boy learned like a boy, you know, but
wow.
Just different.
Yeah.
And she was herself a mathematician, so she was able to suss all of this out. And I was like, and so when you see that kind of articulation just using online curriculum, and you see how the teachers in public schools, as an English teacher, I taught at CUNA for a year, I was given a book, a grammar book, and I hated it. And
yeah.
I really refused to use it.
How do you think the parents pick up on these little intrinsic differences in their children's learning styles, and how would a teacher do that with 30 students?
A professional teacher will be able to tell a parent how to help their kid, for the most part. It's getting the parents to buy in. I spent a lot of time tutoring kids, and I was a professional educator, you know, to start with.
Mm.
You know, but not everybody can, you know, stay at home. And so, you know, if you're working full time, it's a little more difficult to really tune into your kid's classroom and understand, you know, the dynamics of all the students. And in fact, I'm going way back to Superintendent Bayless when I first had Zender, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and I had just enough time to, you know, help. You know, I had this idea that I could train all of the parents in the district to be volunteers in the classroom. Not every parent's a good volunteer. There's a certain rules, you know, the teacher's the boss. There's certain things you don't want to say in front of the kids, you know, kind of thing. And then I would also train the teachers to be patient with the parents and bring them along. What I would do, I said to him, is that I would reduce your class size by 50% by doing that, because you would have one parent in the classroom. You know, there's 30 in a class, there's, you know, 20 to 30 days in a month, right? You'd have a parent in the class pretty much every day, you know, to help the teacher. And the parent would come back once a month, you know, over the school year. And in that way, the parent now is in the classroom once a month, seeing their child in the classroom, in context, and they'll be able to see the problems that their child is having. They'll be able to see the milieu of the other kids, too, and they'll get to know the other parents in a much more intimate way than we currently do. I offered Bayless this at the beginning of the, you know, like in July or June or July, for 3 years.
Resistance to change.
And he said, oh, no, you know, the people who work at the nursery, you know, they're not going to be able to take the day off. And I said, I'll go to the nursery and talk to them, and I bet you they will let them take the day off. And I bet I can find a van that will take them to where they need to go. I'll take care of all of that.
Mm-hmm. Resistance.
And he just wouldn't do it. And it wasn't until years later that I understood the dynamic. I mean, this is as a professional educator, and you're asking me as somebody who will be a parent someday, you know, what the heck goes on in the schools. I didn't understand that it was the unions. So there's teaching unions, and then there's the people who are the support people, and they have a separate union. If I put volunteers in the classroom, I would be taking away union jobs.
Hmm.
So I never solved that problem. But
yeah.
The solution really is to put parents in the classroom. That is the single greatest thing that we could do for
yeah.
all of the kids, all of the parents, and all of the teachers. And,
well,
and in fact, our community. You know,
I don't know why I've been thinking this, but for the past year I've been thinking about creating some kind of finance class where kids learn in high school or middle school about financial planning. Because I never really learned that.
It's a great idea. It's a class that's not taught frequently. And I bet you could do something through the Boys and the Girls Club.
Yeah.
And I think we could also
smart.
Back it up with podcasts and videos, you know, on, you know,
I would really like
Coast
to develop
Buzz.
Something like
and then
that.
And then it stays up as a reference for.
Because all the great books I've read about financing, it would just be great to go over them for myself and create just a short little 30-minute presentation about, hey, this is what I do, and it works for me, and
yeah.
it's been great, and I've been learning since high school about all this stuff. I didn't get interested in that until I was about 22. But once I got hooked, I was like,
right.
This is where it's at. It's
like, I mean, you have to be a capitalist. To survive today, you have to be smart.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be hardworking. And
yeah.
even with real estate, I mean, that's work, but you've turned it into something fun. I see you around town, and you've always got this big smile on your face. And I love that video that Don Padua did of you.
Isn't it great?
My dad
goes, who the fuck would want to see this? I go, I don't know, Dad, but it's bringing smiles to everyone that sees it, and that's all I want, is if someone gets a laugh out of it, that's what I want.
Oh, that is so funny. No, I thought it was a gas, and I think that's the I think it's a really good way of selling yourself, and because you're light and you're fun, but you're professional as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I want to do, is kind of be like the Ritz-Carlton of real estate sales, be really professional, but have a good time while I'm at it, and be easygoing and be able to smile and just bring some laughs everywhere I go. And that's what I try to do with my marketing thing.
I think that's great. And that contest that you promoted.
The contest was awesome because I've been wanting to do that for like 3 years. I bought the domain, you know, I organized it, and then it finally all came together when I had some good sales in real estate and I was able to do that. And it just went off without a hitch. And I had the barbecue down there. I had all the tables. A Surfrider sponsored it and provided the liability insurance, and the waves came.
That's great.
The waves showed up. We had the Brock Little swell. It was like 10 to 12 foot. And I knew the week before because Mike Wallace texted me, "Well, it looks like you got your wish. Maverick swell's happening for your contest." And I said, "Yes, it's on." Because it was all a gamble up to there.
Yeah.
But I was doing all the promoting, which I learned a lot of marketing through this, is that you promote on social media, you promote through all the outlets, you get the sponsors, you build the trophies, you get, and it doesn't take one individual to run a contest. It takes a community.
It does.
Because so many volunteers showed up, and it was all the people I've grown up with to build the stage where the judging tower was, to be the judges all day long, to be the crowd that actually cheered everyone on, and then all the groms that showed up, and all the girls, and all the the older, the masters, and the pro-am, and it was just such it was an exhausting event.
Yeah.
I went to bed at 3 in the morning, I woke up at 4, I started making breakfast burritos, started getting everything in there, I was down at the beach before light, setting up the tents, and by the end of the evening, I was packing in everything, and people are kind of like tipsy, and I'm just laughing because I'm so exhausted. I just dropped all the stuff at my parents' house. I couldn't even make it back to Pacifica, and I just said, "I'll get to it in the morning," because this is – but everyone was just so complimentary of the event.
It was a beautiful thing. You know, Rocky Rayner introduced surfing to my son when he was 10, and I was actually coaching soccer for both Hunter and Xander, and actually Hunter's brother Carson as well. And Carson was just getting into hockey, and Hunter would show up to soccer practice with wet hair, you know, kind of annoyed that he had to get out of the water. And he was in a surfing family, so he was getting it from his older brother Austin too. And I remember Rocky took Hunter and Xander and a couple of other kids down to the Hook. And I'm a boogie boarder, but I'm not a surfer, so I don't know. I can't help him. And I remember Xander catching, you know, a wave on the little Costco red board, and I took the picture, and I just remember the joy on his face. And he just, you know, for about 4 or 5 years, he just absolutely loved surfing. And from that, you know, there's this quad of boys that have grown up together. And, you know, now they're, well, one's going to Channel Islands, one's going to Cal Poly, and Thomas and Xander are going to SBCC. And they're all going to be sort of, you know, there together.
That's awesome.
And
this should be how the college life is.
It is pretty cool. It's been a really neat thing. And so when you do things like, you know, bring this, Clay Johnson, how old is he? 12, 13?
I think he won the longboard division,
didn't
he?
He won the longboard. He beat his dad. And I'm standing next to, you know, his dad's dad while he's videotaping him. So that was really beautiful, too, you know. It's wonderful what you did. That's a great contest, and I hope that we can do some more sponsorships of those types of events, because
that was the best. Really good. It just all came together. I'd love to put those at least two on a year now.
Excellent.
And the next year, it's going to be dedicated to Rocky Corson, because he passed away the next day out surfing the jetty. That was so unexpected, because he texted me that morning. "Hey, I'm really glad you threw that contest. I'm so proud of you. That was awesome." And then he texted me a positive affirmation, because we were going back and forth with positive affirmations.
Right.
And then it was just such a shocker. He had a bad heart, and he just had a heart attack out there and just passed away doing what he loves.
Doing what he loves.
And he was so on fire. Like, he just built the house of his dreams behind his little house. He built this huge two-story dream mansion he was going to retire in. And he was just like, he just moved in with his girlfriend, and he just got back from Hawaii. And he was just like, you could just see he was lit.
Yeah.
And it was just, and I didn't even feel that much remorse with losing him because he was so just content with his life. The people I have remorse for are his loved ones around him that don't get to enjoy his presence anymore. But he was just such a high point in his life at 62 years old. I just thought, God, you know, if there was a time to go, that was it. He wasn't 80 and decrepit and pissed off at life. He was just like living high. And he lived such a good life up to that point too. The stories that man would tell when in his like 20s are just, they get me laughing so hard at times.
It's a beautiful eulogy, Chris.
Right?
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's
nice. So I went to his paddle out, and that was great. It was just nice to kind of send him off with that. Good. A lot of people miss him. Yeah. A lot of people showed up for that, right?
Yeah, it's a small town, so when somebody passes, everybody feels the ripple, you know, effect. And I didn't know Rocky, but I knew of him, you know, from the surf community.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a picture of him on Facebook, and boy, what a joyful face.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
Reminds me of your smile, actually, Chris, too. Ah. You always got joy on your face.
They used to call me Smiley when I was a kid.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, appropriately so.
Right.
Well, Chris, thanks for coming in this morning.
Hey, it was my pleasure. That was a great conversation.
Well, I hope we have more, and we're going to be talking about some surf session sort of interviews, I think. I think we're going to be doing some more stuff.
I hope so.
All right.
Hey, Chris Loswick with the Avant Real Estate Group, signing off.
All right, thanks, Chris. Michelle Dragony, Coastal Butterfly, flitting around.
You've been listening to CoastSiderRadio.com's The Coastal Butterfly with Michelle Dragony. Look for our next podcast coming soon.
I like your Gumby.